Hello, everyone. I'm Aaron Wren, and I'm pleased to have a very special guest on my show today, John Burka. He is the president and CEO of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute and the editor of a new book called Gateway to Statesmanship, Selections from Xenophon to Churchill. Johnny, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Aaron.
Before we dig into the book, for those who don't know, can you just briefly tell people what ISI is?
Absolutely. So ISI is a nonprofit organization that aims to fill the void in a higher education system that has gone mad, as we can see with the recent incident with Harvard's president and the testimony of the Ivy League presidents in Congress. So what we do is basically give students the education that they're not getting in the classroom by hosting over 150 lectures, seminars, and debates for college students, introducing them to the principles of ordered liberty, going all the way back in the Judeo-Christian, Greco-Roman tradition, really giving them the full scope of Western civilization, and perhaps more importantly than the concrete education itself, we are identifying and building a network of the most talented and virtuous and ambitious young conservative leaders at the top schools in the country. We're bringing them together. These are the people that they end up marrying, starting companies with, serving in administrations together. So really building that countercultural leadership network that we hope will one day save America.
Okay, great. And you can check them out at isi.org, I believe is the website.
That's right.
Now, for those who are watching this on YouTube, they can see that you're a pretty young guy. And no offense to you, but you're way too good looking to be giving advice to the prince, to the statesman. So my understanding is in this book, you didn't write this book, but you curated a selection of some of the best writing on this topic from people like King David, Cicero, this Chinese thinker, Han Fei, St. Augustine, Machiavelli, Washington, Roosevelt, Churchill, people like that. It looks really interesting. And I guess I was curious if when you were putting this book together, how much of this was really kind of an excuse to do sort of a reading and research project that you wanted to do for yourself anyway?
That's a great question. So I fell in love with the Mirrors for Princes genre when I was in college 10 years ago. And I kind of just put it on the back burner, forgot about it. And then several years ago, a friend recommended that I consider writing a book. So I started to kind of dive back into some of these classic texts. And that's where I came up with the idea to publish this collection. And it's an interesting point you bring up about my youthfulness and sort of lack of political experience. So why am I the one to be advising princes or at least putting this collection together? There's a couple reasons. The first is that and I'll get into the genre just in a second, but no one, to my knowledge, since the Renaissance has put together a collection of Mirrors for Princes texts, right? So this genre has been entirely forgotten. There are certain books that have been remembered or are still taught with regularity, but on the whole, the tradition has vanished and no one has really engaged with it since the Renaissance. So I'm doing this because simply no one else has done it in recent memory. So what is this tradition? Well, the Mirrors for Princes, these are basically short letters or pamphlets that were presented to political leaders, often kings or queens, either when they were young, princes or princesses, or when they were ascended to the throne and they were a gift. It was a way for an educator or a counselor to offer their services and to provide some advice for the new administration, if you will. The thing that I really love about this genre is that it's not just theory, right? It's very practical leadership advice. This was the self-help book or manual of a previous, more ancient era. And it existed in absolutely every culture, every civilization, from ancient China and India to, the Israel, going all the way back, Greece, Rome, throughout the Middle Ages, the Islamic world, all the way into the Renaissance, where it had a flowering. And then it vanished sometime in the modern era. And there's a few different reasons for that, which perhaps we can get into it at some point.
sounds to me like it would be kind of risky to offer a new king your advice on how he ought to be governing.
Many of the authors ended up dying in rather gruesome ways because the kings eventually, you know, someone like Thomas More, for example, his mirror for princes is Utopia, which is included in the book. And obviously he served Henry VIII and ended up losing his head. So it's a common occurrence.
Yeah, so then that was a pretty high percentage chance there if you're serving Henry VIII that things were not going to go well for you. Well, what I wanted to do was talk through just a few of these to give a sample of what people are going to find in the books. Because, you know, it really is hard. There's so many great books, so many classic texts, and it's really hard to know where to start and what to do. And so a collection like this can be an introduction to different people. And you can decide, oh, is this interesting? Or maybe I'll read more of this guy. You know, it's a kind of a nice way to get an intro, I think, to a number of thinkers that otherwise might, unless you like attended a great books program or something, you might never actually bubble up to the top of your list. So the first essay is one from Xenophon. And I'd really love to hear your take on this because I actually have some questions about it.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And I will say that, you know, most of the advice in this book is presented more in the form of proverbial wisdom. So if you're used to reading the Proverbs, you can kind of understand how that moral advice functions, and you can think of that being applied to statesmen. Xenophon's The Education of Cyrus takes a different approach. The advice is given by telling the story of Cyrus the Great, who was a, you know, conqueror, basically, and he established the world's largest empire at the time, which went from Persia basically to all the way to sort of modern day, you know, Greece. And it tells the story of him being a young boy, the education that he received, and this journey of conquering and leading men while doing it, but then ruling the empire afterwards and what's required to do that. Philip Sidney, who's a British poet, famously noted that because Xenophon, instead of just offering theoretical advice, because he embedded these political principles in narrative form and sort of epic drama form, he said that he told a story that is able to create many more Cyruses throughout history by those who read it, because it captures the imagination, the political imagination of a future leader in the way that simply giving advice won't do.
Yeah, the one that made me, as I was thinking about this, made me think, man, the Persians invaded Greece twice and, you know, almost conquered them. And I don't think it wasn't Cyrus that did it, as I recall. It was like Darius and Xerxes. Weren't those the two guys that, and I never get it straight.
That sounds right. You probably knew it.
But the point is, like, the Greeks were not necessarily known for, you know, to be on great terms with the Persians. So for him to write this piece lauding a Persian king, I thought was really interesting. Mm-hmm. How did that, you know, it seems to have transcended like this animosity. It's almost like saying, you know, we would write an article of some great Russian leader. There's something important to that. It's like, well, these are the enemies, right?
Sure.
Now, of course, we probably wouldn't pick Putin or Stalin, but, you know, even if you went back to, like, you know, one of the czars or something, it's still a little interesting. I think there must have been something really about him that was a compelling figure.
There was. And I mean, Alexander the Great venerated Cyrus, you know, I think famously went to the tomb of Cyrus to pay homage to him. And also Xenophon, you know, there's both some historic truth and also a lot of embellishment to the Cyrus, or Xenophon's portrait of Cyrus is also a fictional portrait of Cyrus. So,
well, there's value in that as well. I love how you talked about, like, a lot of these are proverbial wisdom, because statesmanship is really the art of, you know, prudence and making wise choices when there aren't, like, easy black and white rules to apply. So you have to have this, like, repertoire of ideas and actions that you can draw from, examples, but knowing which one to apply is more art than science, I think, which is something we don't like to think about that today. But obviously that's something that would have been top of mind, I think, for many of the leaders.
Yeah. And I think it makes people uncomfortable today to think of you know, a great statesman with their hand on the rudder of the ship of state, you know, navigating through tumultuous waters and not being able to control the winds, but figuring out how to, you know, direct the sails. That makes people uncomfortable. And I think you saw at the beginning of the progressive era, really a shift away from that understanding of statesmanship to an expert class, to bureaucratic management. Mm-hmm. It just feels safer, a little bit more comfortable if we can kind of tweak and finesse society through these apparatuses that experts control. And so, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why these texts lost their popularity.
Yeah, I mean, today, you know, the great man theory of history is a little bit out of favor. And yet when we think about even just like history of the last 100 years, so much of it is the history of what we people would say a great leader, like an FDR or a Churchill or people like that. I'm actually just writing an article about the former mayor of my own city. People talk about these legendary mayors like Richard J. Daley or, you know, Michael Bloomberg or Rudolph Giuliani. You know, I studied urban policy a lot. And I think of that as like there is this sense of like the idea of the wise ruler or statesman. We do still even today look at that when we see it, when we see somebody that's done it well.
That's right.
It's still, I think, yeah, like, wow, why don't we have leaders like that today? We certainly feel keenly this lack of leadership in our country.
Sure. And I think conservatives have put, and for some good reasons, but we've put most of our emphasis on institutions, understanding them, you know, building them, looking at political problems through the lens of institutions. And the Mirrors for Princes genre as a whole, but specifically the Xenophon's Education of Cyrus, is maybe setting institutions aside for a moment and saying, what would it, it's pinning its hope on a great leader, right? That's its approach to politics. And now you see at the end of the book, that's not entirely sufficient because this empire that he builds and rules and maintains, the moment that he dies and passes it on to his two sons, it falls apart. You know, dissipation reigns, the education system crumbles. And so it kind of leaves this question about whether a great leader is sufficient, or do you also need these institutions? And so it's a tough, you know, perennial question.
Right. And conservatives also like to talk about the virtue of the citizenry a lot.
That's right.
And the Republic, you know, they're certainly critical that the citizens be virtuous, but that doesn't obviate the need for virtuous leaders and powerful, wise, prudent leaders as well. I think it's a good relationship there. Another one that's in here is a selection from Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. Mm-hmm. So I guess my first question is, how do you actually pronounce Nicomachean? I hear it pronounced all kinds of weird ways. Maybe you have a better pronunciation than I do.
I say Nicomachean, but I don't.
Yeah, it's like one of these things. There's so many things that I hear, and I try to look them up sometimes, and I can't even get an authoritative pronunciation. But this is one of his most famous works. I've actually read this one. What did you pick out of Aristotle's Ethics?
Yeah, so there was a question. I wanted to include Aristotle. You can argue whether or not he belongs strictly in the Mirrors for Princes genre, because this book, you know, to my knowledge, wasn't necessarily, although he tutored Alexander the Great, to my knowledge, it wasn't necessarily presented as a gift to him. But the reason that I chose it is because there's this chapter on the magnanimous man in the book. And in my view, you know, you can read this, and in some respects, he's a very proud man. He doesn't have many friends. He thinks he's self-sufficient. He's arrogant. You know, it says he doesn't speak of his enemies unless it's to insult them. You know, there's all these kind of great puzzling lines to us. But in another sense, Aristotle sort of describes him as having the perfection of the moral virtues embodied in himself. And I was trying to really wrestle with this and square, you know, how can this man be the perfection of the virtues if there are so many characteristics that just seem off-putting, you know? And it's bookended by chapters on magnificence and generosity. And really, I started to read The Magnanimous Man as Aristotle's ideal portrait of a statesman. because some of these actions, yeah, if it was an individual acting this way towards their friends, you would say, all right, they're too full of themselves. But if it's a statesman who's responsible for the protection of his people, he's responsible, he or she is responsible for dealing with both external threats and internal threats to the regime. There are many ways in which you're required to act publicly that the morality might be different than in your interpersonal relations.
Yeah, that's like a recurring theme in some of this literature, is this, like, there's a difference between the statesman as statesman and like the individual citizen, and what constitutes sort of excellence in each of those roles. Very different.
It is very different. I think people often think that it's not different, and it even makes them uncomfortable to consider that the ethical dimensions are different. But it's pretty clear once you start, you just listen to biographies of great leaders and you'll understand why it has to be a little bit different.
Right. Another one, this is one I found really interesting that you put in there, was from King David of the Kingdom of Israel. And you're like, well, what did he write? Well, he wrote Psalms in the Bible. And so you pick Psalm 72 as something is in there. And I hadn't thought quite offhand what was in Psalm 72. Again, some of the Psalms I know, and I read it, and it really is a sort of portrait, if you will, of the ideal prince. Maybe, I don't know if it's considered messianic in its implications, but it sort of got that idea of perfect justice in there. What are some of the things from that?
Sure. Well, part of the reason I picked that, so that psalm is what, part of what's been considered the royal psalms. These are psalms that have, messianic, overtones, but it's also, like you said, painting sort of the ideal portrait of a king who kind of rightly orders his regime, not only towards justice, but towards not only towards a temporal justice, but towards these more transcendent ultimate ends of right worship of God. And this psalm was actually sung at the coronation for King Charles, which took place last year. So it has, there's a tradition of it being included in some of the ceremonies around coronations. So that's why I picked that one. There is another text that I do want to plug also from ancient Israel, which is the book of Judith, the story of Judith, which I include there, which is another remarkable story. I think that highlights what you mentioned about how the ethical dimensions of statesmanship are a little bit sort of a different world you're entering. That was a case where the Israelites were surrounded by the Assyrians. They were Jerusalem was about to be conquered. And she basically got more or less a vision from God in prayer that she was to go behind enemy lines and seduce Holofernes, the general of the Assyrians. And the priests, more or less gave the blessing, but she kind of deceived them a little bit. She's a very beautiful woman, but also very pious, a widow. And she goes behind enemy lines and she seduces the general. She's in his tent late at night. She gets him drunk. He's intoxicated. He's intending to, dishonor her. And then he ends up passing out of drunkenness. She, goes outside. She prays to God and comes back in and cuts his head off. And puts it in a bag and then goes back to Jerusalem and shows them the head. And then the Assyrians wake up in a state of confusion and disarray. And in that chaos, the Jews go out and slaughter them. So again, it's this story of, God sort of miraculously preserved her from this man. But she really has to put a lot of chips on the table to make that happen. So there is this kind of calculated risk and daring. And so I included that because I also think, many people don't know of that story, but it's another great example of statesmanship that I think in many ways draws from the lessons in that Psalm of David.
Mm-hmm. Now, some of that, the stuff we talked about now is kind of what you might call ancient literature, but you pick things that, go from all throughout history, which I think was interesting. Again, including Thomas Aquinas, of course, from the Middle Ages. And I've never read any of Thomas Aquinas, and the reason is simple. It's like your shelves would fill like a massive, massive thing shelving there. I believe you included something in here, which this is one I'll admit I did not have a chance to read before our podcast. So give people a preview on it. I'm really interested in hearing it. He's someone I've been super interested in. But again, it's just so daunting because he wrote so much.
Absolutely. And you know, I'm not a Aquinas expert. There are many of my Catholic friends who are much more knowledgeable about Aquinas than I am. But in terms of this particular text, it's a short treatise written to the King of Cyprus. And he's essentially, this one is at parts more theoretical, but it also has some practical nuggets of wisdom. You know, he's basically outlining, his ideal form of government, which for Thomas Aquinas is kingship. You know, the title of the book is On Kingship. Mm-hmm. And he makes sort of an Aristotelian case for why the rule of one individual makes the most sense. It's for him, it's a more effective way for a virtuous leader to order society. And for him, you know, it really is about ordering society towards ultimate ends, towards God, towards the church. There's an interesting line in there about how he does think kings are subject to the papacy and Rome, mm-hmm. which I personally do not believe or share. But there's a few other interesting things. You know, one of them is he really stresses that, you know, for a king, he says, you're not going to have any permanent or enduring happiness in this world. So he stresses the ephemeral nature of the king's rule and says the only way a king can be happy is by having eternal treasures. And as a king, you're going to have a lot of noise in your life. Your whole life, right, is going to be one interruption after another, one thing going bad, another thing going off the rails, strategizing, plotting. And so he really puts the emphasis on the king sort of anchoring his soul in these more permanent, enduring things. And he says that's the only way you'll actually get stability, permanence, and happiness. He also places a lot of emphasis on the importance of beauty, even in terms of physical buildings, and sort of as a way to order society towards the good. And then there's even an amusing line, a couple of amusing lines at the end about being wary of merchants, you know, this sort of merchant mentality undermine a regime. There's even a protectionist sort of plug that Aquinas makes towards the end about sort of producing goods locally, which I found amusing and appreciated.
Wow, sounds great. I mean, I think there's a lot to criticize in the merchant mentality. It's a good thing in its proper place, but you know, society has become too dominated by merchants, it's not always a good thing. It's not always a good thing. You know, moving forward like a little bit more, and I would have put this, if you'd asked me to pick one kind of Mirrors for Princess thing, I would have picked Machiavelli, because I do believe didn't he write The Prince for someone that really was one of these things? And yet he's got such a bad reputation. And so how do you see Machiavelli, and what did you include from him?
Yeah, so I included selections from The Prince. You know, I mean, historically, Machiavelli, you know, he served, he was part of the Florentine Republic, which ended up being overthrown by the papacy with the help of the Spanish. He was exiled for a period, tortured, imprisoned, you know, and then he sort of was released. And so you can kind of, I think, understand the Machiavellian mentality that we criticize a little bit better when you hear the circumstances of his own life and kind of just the brute power politics that he was involved in. And then he retires out to his a farm and estate in the country. And, you know, he talks about how every day, you know, there's busyness, he's going to and fro, meeting with people, working. And then at the end of the day, he comes into his study and he closes the door and lights a fire and he takes the books from his shelves and he communes with the greatest minds and the greatest statesmen from history. And they're right there, you know? Mm. And in that moment, nothing in the world matters but that. And so you can kind of get inside his head a little bit and appreciate it. So I've included, a couple chapters from Machiavelli's The Prince. You know, I do really think it's a commanding book. I mean, I read it in college, but then I read it again as I was going through this whole litany of things. And I mean, there were multiple times that I just had to set the book down and be, you know, just think, wow, he really understands human nature in a profound way. It's very much a foil to Cicero, because Cicero is saying in On Duties, you know, basically, like, if you do the right thing, if you think the right things, if you do the right things, things are going to work out for you, you know? And Machiavelli really takes a very different point. And he basically says, look, you can believe all the right things, but that has no bearing on whether or not you're going to make the right decisions as the head of a head of state. You know, similar to how you could be you could have a great Christian doctor, great conservative Christian doctor, but they might be absolutely terrible at brain surgery. You know, you're not going to want them to operate on you, but you might have someone who's just total godless and terrible lifestyle, but maybe they're a great brain surgeon. You know, you're going to go with them for the brain surgery. I say that. I do actually think there is a connection between piety and being a good ruler. But for Machiavelli and his logic, he says, you know, better to have someone who's good at understanding human nature and doing what needs to be done for the sake of preserving order than having someone who's too carried away with their piety or with their ideology. One point from Machiavelli that I think is really that I found the most commanding is he's really talking about the role of fortune in making a good prince and this interplay between an aspiring prince and fortune and whether or not the prince has any control of fortune. And at the end of the book, he talks about how when fortune wants to make a prince great, what does she do? You know, and he says, fortune brings in front of him enemies and obstacles, okay? And these enemies and obstacles are ladders by which the prince can either be, you know, crushed or can climb to greatness. And when I think of sort of just how this turns into practical advice, one of the things that I love to tell ISI students when I'm teaching through this text is that as a leader, every week in our life, there are things that go wrong. They go off the rails. Oftentimes, they're totally outside of our control. We don't know when they're going to happen. But at least one thing every week kind of goes wrong. And I think we often like to think that, you know, each week we all have a to-do list. We're very busy. And that your job as a leader is to merely just check off the things on your to-do list. And I think that couldn't be further from the truth. I think your job as a leader is not only to check those things off your to-do list, but it's actually to anticipate these things that are going to go wrong, to even look forward to them. Because really what makes you a better leader, what takes you to the next level is how you respond to those mini crises each week. Because all of your team is going to be looking to you in those moments. And they're going to see, are you swearing under your breath? Is your anxiety, right? Is it radiating to the team? Is it demoralizing other people? Or, you know, in those little moments, right? Are you responding with control? Are you responding deliberately? And are you working through the problem, you know, while still being able to kind of, you know, do the things on your to-do list? So I think Machiavelli, I found him to be very helpful with some of these practical tips for leaders.
Yeah, The Prince is another one that I've read, and it has the virtue of being short as well. Unlike Aquinas, you know, my wife, you know, always points out that whether or not I read a book often depends on how long it is. I've read a lot of very long books, but like it is kind of mind blowing. And he's really the guy that again comes to mind when you think about the difference between the ethical duty of the prince and sort of the ordinary man. And many of his many famous lines around the prince needing to know how to commit evil as well as good. In order, I don't know if I would endorse all of that, but he's something else, and he's not afraid to just look into the abyss and tell you what he finds there.
Yeah, and I think there's, I certainly don't endorse just the blanket idea of, you know, doing evil and in order to kind of get to good outcomes or beneficial outcomes. But I do think it's what's important is that when you read Machiavelli, you know, as a statesman, like he's often telling the truth about how people act in politics. So even if you're a good, virtuous, just ruler, right, you need to understand how your enemies, right, your opponents, even I think on the world stage, are going to be acting against you. Mm-hmm. And you can't do that if you're just only in the realm of theory, right?
Yeah. Well, I actually had more I could go through here, but I want to pivot to another topic, which is I was really intrigued by this when we were, you know, arranging to set up this podcast. You made the point that there's a lot of overlap or relationship between statesmanship and masculinity. And I'm very obviously most of the princes and statesmen of history were men overwhelmingly. But I'm very intrigued by this and what you think would love to hear you tell more.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, and I would say you're right. You know, most of the statesmen are men. I think in the there are certain exceptions. I think more in the Catholic and Orthodox worlds, you know, you do have. I think maybe it even has something to do with the devotion to the Virgin Mary. You know, there have been numerous queens that are also very worthy of imitation. But as I look at the genre as a whole, you know, I didn't mention really masculinity. I wrote an introduction at the beginning of the book. It didn't really come to mind as I was going throughout the process, but then sort of looking back upon it, I think there's a couple reasons why masculinity really stood out to me as I looked at the genre. The first one is this genre, you know, today when we think about who is offering advice to men, right? The advice that's being offered mostly, you know, on the internet by, you know, Jordan Peterson and others is actually very practical advice. You know, it's lifestyle advice for mm-hmm. men, even more than just like the theory of what it means to be a man. It's practical things. I think you said
I agree completely.
Podcast. Yeah. Make your bedroom. Right. And so the reason that I love this genre on the whole is that it's not just theoretical, it's connecting theory to action and making it very practical so that leaders in any domain can implement principles and become better, right? And it actually embeds a component of self-interest. You know, do these things in your life and you're going to actually be more successful. And so as I kind of look at this cultural moment and see men looking for direction in practical ways, I think the genre is very helpful to offer practical advice that's actually, I think, rooted in some more permanent realities in virtue, you know, in a proper understanding of religion, that some of the online influencers, you know, like Andrew Tate are lacking. And then secondly, I think if you just look through the list of virtues that are associated with sort of being a good statesman, you know, restraint, piety, courage, protection, justice, prudence, power, prosperity, you know, in some sense, you know, there's a masculine quality to some of these characteristics. And I think when properly understood, can offer a very compelling and positive vision for masculinity.
Well, you're right that so many of these online men's influencers, and of course, Andrew Tate being the most infamous, their concept of masculinity and manhood is so directed to base motives, like, you know, getting rich, buying Bugattis, sleeping with lots of women. And there is something about this that elevates one's eyes towards higher aims mm-hmm. in life than those sorts of petty concerns. And then there is something, you know, this famous book, Manhood in the Making by David Gilmour. He was an anthropologist, I believe, who mm-hmm. surveyed all these cultures and what they said about masculinity. And he always made the point, and this is a very commonly made point, that, you know, unlike womanhood, which women essentially mature into by default, there's no idea that you have to earn your female status or earn women. Masculinity was always an earned status, and that you had to you have to earn it and prove that you measured up to the standard through engagement in the public square, through you know, competition in the real world under the eyes of other people, right? And being out, you know, at battle, on the hunt, et cetera, being able to actually perform, compete, and demonstrate that you mm-hmm. met the standard in the real world, in the public square, was a big part of that. And quintessentially, that is the quintessential role, I think, of the king mm-hmm. or of the prince, in Machiavelli's terms, is very much about that. And, you know, Jack, and one of these online influencers, Jack Donovan, you know, he made the point, you know, yes, women can do that too, but what makes many of these things masculine qualities is that only men are judged relative to them.
Interesting.
You know, if you do it, if you're a man who fails in this, you're going to be judged. Where if you're a woman who doesn't do these things, nobody's going to say you're defective as a woman. And so it's less about whether women can be, you know, be strong or whatever, which they can be, but they're not judged on strength as to whether they measure up to a feminine standard or not, which I thought was kind of an interesting twist on it. But there is an element of this of sort of elevate your eyes towards higher aims. The one thing, I guess I maybe coming up on kind of closing it off, this is interesting because we did talk about the difference between the ethical dimensions of kingship and sort of everyday life. And so these mirrors for princes are aimed at the king. So how is this relevant and how can it be applied to people mm-hmm. who are in, not in that political role, not in the statesman role? Maybe you're a father, maybe you're a businessman, maybe you're running an organization like you are, maybe you're, you know, in the public square like I am with ideas. How should we think about these things relative to the milieu in which most of us live?
Sure. And I would say, I think it's incredibly relevant, because regardless of what domain you're in, right? You could be the captain of your sports team. You could be student council president. You could be a business owner. You could be a leader in any sort of capacity. I think every leader should, you know, have a desire. I mean, basically to really take these first principles that I think most people, courage, restraint, mercy, right? Prudence, these sort of more kind of cardinal virtues, temperance, right? And in desire to manifest them in their own life. And I think it's hard to do because in the abstract, many human beings aren't inclined, you know, to be good. But at the same time, they also don't know how to be good and to reorder their desires. And so I think the great thing about this genre is that it, you know, just like it does for the statesman when it's helping him or her in the realm of politics to make prudential decisions, it really offers advice that can help anyone learn that art of being virtuous in daily life, in their interactions with their family members, with their coworkers, with their children, or, you know, when you go out into the public square. And so I think it's one of those things that in the abstract, it might seem hard, you know, how on earth does advice for princes apply to my life? But if you were to open up the book and start reading through it, I think most people in whatever domain will start to be inspired to be better in small ways.
All right. Thank you very much. Again, the book is called Gateway to Statesmanship: Selections from Xenophon to Churchill, edited by John Burka. Again, he's the president of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. I'll put a link both to buy the book and to visit ISI's website in the show notes. You'll definitely want to check that out. Johnny, thank you so much for joining me.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, Aaron.